12 days later, having struggled with fluky and variable winds, Mungo St. John played the field of his glass down the open, gaping moor of False Bay. On his right hand rose the distinctive curved black peak of Hunklip, shaped from this angle like a shark's dorsal fin, and directly opposite, across the mouth of the bay, the southernmost tip of the African continent, Cape Point, with its lighthouse perched high above the steep, wet cliffs. It was a magnificent Cape summer's day, a light and fickle breeze scratching dark patches on the surface of the rolling dark blue sea, leaving the rest of it with a satiny gloss. There were seabirds working, their wings twinkling like flurry snowflakes in the sunlight, huge flocks of them that stretched low across the horizon. Creeping along on the breeze, lying for minutes at a time, completely becalmed, Huron took half a day to round the point and came on to west-northwest and a point north, the course that would carry her up the Atlantic, across the equator, and finally into Charleston Roads. Once they were on their new course, Mungo St. John had leisure to inspect the other sails that were in sight. There were 10 other vessels in view now, for there was another far out to sea, just her topsails showing. There were small fishing craft out from Hout Bay and Table Bay, and the seabirds clouded the air about them. Most of them were between Huron and the land, and all of them were bare-masted or under working sail as they plied their lines or their nets. Only the vessel furthest out was carrying topsails, and though she was hull down, she gave to Mungo's seaman's eye the impression of being a bigger ship than the rest of the fishing fleet. "There's a ship for you," Tipu exclaimed, touching Mungo's arm to draw his attention. And when he swung his glass back towards the land, Mungo murmured with pleasure as a square-rigged East Indiaman came into view around the headland that guarded the entrance to Table Bay itself. She was as splendid to sight as Huron was herself, canvas piled to the sky, and her paintwork gleaming in snowy white and burgundy red. The two lovely ships on reciprocal courses passed each other by 2 cables' length, the officers eyeing each other through their telescopes with professional interest and appraisal as they paid passing honours. Robin was also at Huron's rail, pining towards the land. The proximity of the beautiful ship interested her hardly at all. It was that flat-topped mountain from which she could barely tear her gaze. It was so very close, marking as it did her one hope of succour. Her friends there, the British governor and the Cape Squadron, if they only knew that she was a prisoner aboard this slave ship. The thought was interrupted by an abrupt movement that she caught from the corner of her eye. Strange how receptive she was to Mungo St. John's smallest movement, to his slightest change of expression. And now she saw that he had turned his back on the East Indiaman as she dwindled away astern, and instead he was peering intently over Huron's port side, his expression rapt. His whole body seemed charged with latent energy, and the hands that gripped the barrel of the telescope were ivory-knuckled with tension. Quickly she followed his gaze, and for the first time noticed a tiny shred of white on the horizon that did not fade like the white caps of the waves, but stood constant and bright in the sunlight, though even as she watched it seemed to alter its shape slightly. And was it her imagination? Or was it a thin, dark, wavering line that seemed to appear behind it and spread slowly away in the direction of the wind? "Mr. Tipu, what do you make of that sail?" she heard the timbre of concern and alarm in Mungo St. John's tone, and her heart leapt wildly with hope and a Judas dread. For Clinton Codrington it had been a desperate run down the eastern coastline of southern Africa. Long days and sleepless nights of unceasing strain, when hope and despair pendulumed against each other. Each shift or change in the wind either alarmed or encouraged him, for it would either aid or hinder the tall clipper ship she was racing to head. The calms elated him, and the revival of the southeasterly prevailing winds sent his spirits plunging. On the last days, there was another worry to plague him. He had burned his coal like a spendthrift on the long 1,000-mile run southwards, and his engineer came up on deck, a small red-headed Scot with the grease and coal dust etched into his skin, so that he seemed to be suffering from some debilitating and incurable disease. "The stoker's shovels be hitting the bottom of the bunkers already," he told Clinton with mournful relish. I warned ye, sir, that we'd not make it if you... Burn the ship's furniture if you must, Clinton snapped at him. You can start with my bunk. I'll not be needing it. And when the engineer would have argued further, Clinton added, I don't care how you do it, Mr. MacDonald, but I want a full head of steam on your boiler until I reach Cape Point, and another full head of steam when I bring this ship into action. They raised the Cape Point lighthouse a few minutes after midnight the following night, and Clinton's voice was hoarse with fatigue and relief as he stooped over the voice pipe. Mr. MacDonald, you can let your fires damp down, but keep your furnaces warmed and ready to stoke. When I ask for steam again, I'll need it in a hurry. You'll be calling at Table Bay to take on fresh bunkers, of course, sir. I'll let you know when, Clinton promised him, and snapped the lid of the speaking tube closed and straightened up. The Cape Naval Base, with all its amenities, lay only a few hours steaming away. By dawn, he could be filling Black Joke with coal and water and fresh vegetables. However, Clinton knew that within minutes of dropping anchor in Table Bay, Admiral Kemp or one of his representatives would be on his way out to the ship, and Clinton's term of independent command would be over. He would revert to being a very junior commander, whose recent actions needed a great deal of explanation. The closer that Clinton drew to Admiralty House, the louder the warnings of Sir John Bannerman rang in his ears, and the more soberly he was forced to review his own position. The excitement of storming Arab barracoons and of seizing slave-laden dhows on the high seas had long ago cooled, and Clinton realized that once he entered it, he would not be able to escape again from Table Bay for weeks, or possibly months. It would not even suit his immediate plans to be seen and recognized from the land, for a boat would immediately be sent out by Admiral Kemp to order him to face judgment and retribution. Clinton felt not the least trepidation about the Navy's ultimate judgment. He was so indifferent to the threat hanging over his career that he surprised even himself. There was only one desire, one object in his mind that overshadowed all else. He must have his ship in position to intercept Huron as she rounded the Cape, if she had not already done so. Nobody and nothing must prevent him from doing so. After that, he would face his accusers with complete equanimity. Huron and Robin Ballantyne first. Beside them, all else was pale and insignificant. Mr. Denham, he called his lieutenant across the dark deck. We will take up night patrol station 10 miles off Cape Point, and I am to be called immediately the lights of any ship are sighted. As Clinton threw himself down, fully dressed and booted, upon his bunk, he experienced the first peace of mind since leaving Zanzibar Harbour. He had done all that was in his power to reach Cape Point ahead of Huron, and now the rest was in the hands of God, and his trust in God was implicit. He fell asleep almost instantly, and his steward woke him again an hour before dawn. He left the mug of coffee to grow cold beside his bunk and hurried on deck, reaching it a few seconds ahead of Lieutenant Denham. No ships during the night, sir. Ferris, who had the watch, saluted him. Very well, Mr. Ferris, Clinton acknowledged. We'll take up our daylight patrol station immediately. By the time the light was strong enough for a watcher on the shore to make out any details, Black Joke had retreated tactfully below the horizon, and it would have taken a sharp eye to pick out the occasional flash of her topsail, let alone to identify the gunboat and to speed a report to Admiral Kemp that his prodigal had returned. From Black Joke's masthead, the land was a low, irregular distortion of the horizon. But a ship rounding the Cape would be many miles closer than the land. Huron's mainmast was almost 150 feet tall. Her sails would shine like a flaming beacon, and as long as the fog did not come down, which was unlikely at this season of the year, Clinton was confident that she could not slip by him. The only disquiet that scratched him like a burr as he paced his deck, and the gunboat settled down into the regular four-sided box-pattern legs of her patrol, was that Huron had long ago flown northwards on this fine wind that at last bore steadily out of the southeast at almost gale force, and that she was already lost in the endless washery green wastes of the southern Atlantic Ocean, leaving Black Joke to guard the gate of an empty cage. He was not left long to brood. The first sighting was called down to the deck from the lookouts in the crow's nest at the main peak, and Clinton's nerves jumped tight and his expectations flared. "What do you make of her?" he called up through the voice trumpet. Small lugger." And his expectations plunged. A fishing boat out of Table Bay. There would be many of them. But each time he could not control the wild surge of excitement when another sail was sighted, so that by nightfall his nerves were ragged and his body ached with exhaustion as he gave the order for Black Joke to take up her inshore patrol station for the night. But even then he could not rest. For three times during the night he was called from his bunk, and he stumbled, owl-eyed, on deck as Black Joke went down to investigate running lights that winked ruby red and emerald green out of the darkness. Each time the same leap of expectation, the steeling of nerves for instant orders and swift action, and then the same letdown as the lights proved to belong to small trading vessels, and the gunboat sheered away quickly, lest she be recognized and her presence off the Cape be reported in Table Bay. In the dawn, Clinton was on deck again, as the gunboat moved further offshore to take up her daylight patrol station. He was distracted by the sighting reports as his masthead lookout picked up the first sails of the fishing fleet coming out for the day's business, and by the lugubrious report of his coal-stained Scottish engineer. "He'll not last out the day, sir," MacDonald told him, "even though I'm burning just enough coal to keep the furnace warm. We've not more than a bucket or two left." "Mr. MacDonald," Clinton interrupted him, trying to keep his temper under control and to disguise his exhaustion, "this ship will stay on station until I give the order. I don't care what you burn, but you are to give me steam when I ask for it, or kiss goodbye to the fattest bundle of prize money that will ever come your way." Despite this brave promise and threat, Clinton's hopes were sinking swiftly. They had been on station for more than a day and a night already. He could not bring himself to believe that he had beaten the swift clipper to the Cape by that margin, not unless she had been somehow miraculously delayed, and every hour increased the certainty that she had run clear away from him, taking her cargo and the woman he loved out of his life forever. He knew he should go below to rest, but his cabin was stifling in the rising summer heat, and in it he felt like a trapped animal. He stayed on deck, unable to keep still for more than a few moments at a time, poring over the chart table and fiddling with the navigational instruments before throwing them down again and resuming his nervous pacing, shooting quick glances up at the masthead and then roaming the ship, so obviously intent on finding fault or criticizing the ship's running, that his officers followed his lanky figure with troubled expressions, while the watch on deck was silent and subdued, not one of them daring to glance in his direction, until Clinton's voice rose in a coldly furious cry that froze them all. "Mr. Denham!" The lieutenant almost ran to the sons. "This deck is a pigsty. What animal is responsible for this filth?" On the white holystone deck planking was a brown splash of tobacco juice, and Denham stared at it for an instant before wheeling away to bellow a series of orders that had a dozen men scampering. The activity was so intense, the atmosphere electric, as captain and lieutenant stood over four men on their knees scrubbing furiously at the offending stain, while others carried buckets of seawater and still others rigged the deck pump, that the hail from the masthead was almost ignored. It was left to Ferris to acknowledge it and to inquire through the voice trumpet, "What do you make of her?" "She's howled down, but she's a four-masted ship, square-rigged." The activity on the deck ceased instantly, every head lifting as the lookout went on elaborating on his sighting. "She's on course to weather the Cape. Now she's coming round to a heading of north-northwest or thereabouts." Clinton Codrington was the first to move. He snatched the telescope out of Lieutenant Denham's hand and ran to the ratlines. With the telescope tucked in his belt, he began to climb hand over hand. He went up steadily, never pausing nor faltering, not even when he reached the futtock shrouds, and for a few moments hung over backwards, 100 feet above the swaying deck. However, when he reached the crow's nest at the main peak and tumbled into it, thankfully, his breath was sawing dryly in his throat and the blood sang in his ears. He had not climbed like that since he had been a midshipman.